shunda la scala la ski, sunda la 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 la.
Keep going, man. Everyone in America says that they're middle class. Like, whether it's the billionaire or the janitors, ever says that they're anything but middle class.
You're desperate. Well, you need to show your faith by giving to the church, often beyond your means. You know, the bigger leap of faith you're making, the bigger return you will get.
If you're wealthy, obviously you're close to God, but the best way to get God's favor is to actually bankrupt yourself.
I was going to church like 9 times a week. I was involved in so many different churches. I had nothing in my life that wasn't church related. This is basically agonizing torture where you pray for death and won't get it.
What is the ex-evangelical movement and how did you come to embrace it? Hi, this is Scott Carney Investigates. I am so excited to have Josiah Hesse on the program today. I've known him for years. He's a local Denver journalist, grew up in the evangelical movement, and then moved over to the ex-evangelical world. And if you don't know what any of that is, don't worry, we're going to get into it shortly. Josiah has written this amazing book called Runner's High, which is about why, if you're an endurance athlete, you should definitely be smoking pot. And it's a great book, and it's right there on that shelf behind him. And we're not talking about that, really. We're not really going to be talking about why you need to smoke pot and run. Instead, you're going to read his book. Without much further ado, do remember, though, that down there in the description, there's a link to the Patreon. If you like interviews like this, you know, get them a little early and join the Patreon community. All right, Josiah, thank you so much for being here at, the Pokey Bear LLC Studios in Denver. The first thing I want to ask, let's just jump right in. What is the evangelical movement in America? Give me just the brief summary.
It's one of those words that kind of means different things to different people, you know, like being or means different things depending on the time period you're in, like saying a Democrat, you know, being a Democrat today means something very different than it did 150 years ago. But basically, evangelical, there's a National Association of Evangelicals, and the definition of it is you believe in the born again experience, a sort of emotional conversion experience to the specific type of Christianity. You believe more or less in the inerrancy of the Bible. There's some flexibility on that. There's the term fundamentalist, which means everything in the Bible is 100% true, historically, scientifically, and pretty much anything outside of the Bible is, bullshit.
is this a new movement? Like, where did evangelical come from? Because, you know, a lot of me wasn't raised Christian. There's the Protestants, there are the Catholics, there's the Christian as the broader hierarchy. When does evangelical become a word? Where does it come from?
I believe started around the 18th century in New England. It's under the Protestant banner. I mean, you can be an evangelical Catholic. That's a whole other splitting hairs thing. But it started with what's kind of known as the Great Awakening, the first Great Awakening in America around the colonial period. And there was just a lot of sort of outdoor revival meetings with a lot of celebrity preachers who would preach to massive audiences throughout all of New England. And people would have these very emotional conversion experiences, often with baptisms in rivers and lakes. It was very communal. It was very getting back to nature. And it was really stripped of any kind of authority or hierarchy. That's different today, but it was very much the Martin Luther idea of your own personal relationship with God, your own personal relationship with the Bible. But activism was also a big part of it. Like, you're either proselytizing to other people, or in many cases, you're taking care of the poor. It was a very progressive movement, or at least various threads of it. I mean, we think of today with evangelicals being a part of the Christian right, part of the GOP. So they want to cut taxes, they want to cut welfare. But at one time, it was very much like, you took care of the poor, and that's how you were defined as an evangelical by your works to help people.
That's really interesting. You know, at one point, you know, you just said when you introduced it, you said that evangelicalism is like sort of believes that every word literally in the Bible is true. It's sort of this fundamentalist thing. And yet you also just said it's about your personal experience, your personal relationship with God. How can both be active at the same time?
Well, these are really monocultures. They're very isolated, so you don't often get challenged by outside ideas or outside beliefs. So your own personal relationship with God or with Christianity is still very much defined by these cultural tropes, fundamentalism being one of them. And it's just so much easier to maintain your faith and your belief, which, and we can get into this in a minute, your salvation, your ticket out of hell and into heaven is your belief. So it is imperative that you keep that simple and straightforward. Otherwise, you're going to basically think your way into hell, which was what was on my mind quite a bit as a young man.
Yeah, we're going to get into your childhood soon and your own personal history. But I want context because, you know, again, I wasn't raised a Christian. I was raised in, I think we would call them heathens. But I want to understand, before we get into the sort of bigger story that we're getting into, I want to understand why this evangelical movement, this sort of almost like American fundamentalist movement, why it's so popular? What is it that captivated, you know, millions of people in America? Mm-hmm. What was the need that it answered?
Well, the short answer is communism, the Cold War. It was really in the mid 20th century where church attendance was dropping off. After World War II, there was a lot of disillusionment with God and faith. And it wasn't like the atheist movement of Richard Dawkins and Bill Maher today, but people were sort of sliding away from it. And Eisenhower at the time was, you know, fighting the Cold War, and he partnered with Billy Graham to sort of make America more of a Christian identified nation. This is when we put "In God We Trust" on our currency. This is when we added One Nation Under God to the pledge and started making the Pledge of Allegiance part of a regular thing in schools. It was very much fusing patriotism with Christian identity because so much of communism was associated with atheism. They, you know, churches were banned, Bibles were banned in the USSR. So it was a very convenient opportunity to be like, well, they're the godless intellectual heathens, and we are going to be the patriotic Christian nation. And Billy Graham, you know, inarguably the most successful preacher of the 20th century, basically defined American Christianity. His revivals were explosively popular with people of all ages. And so you had a church attendance spike in the 50s and 60s. You had Christian identity just sort of be the norm, and any sort of atheist identity, you know, brought scorn upon you. So if anyone did have, you know, controversial beliefs, they kept them to themselves at that time.
And that's amazing to think. I mean, you put it so well. Like, you know, when I think about communism, you think about the critique, those godless commies, right? That's like sort of a phrase that's out there. But to put the rise of our current evangelical, sort of more fundamentalist bent to Christianity in the context of the Cold War, you know, makes so much sense because war is ideological, right? You know, we're fighting the commies. We're, you know, there's this economic system that we don't like, and everything associated with it is wrong, and everything that we do is right. So it sort of creates this polarization inside the country, right? You know, it's a purity test, if you will. That is so, because the Cold War infects everything, right? You know, the Cold War is the war on drugs. The Cold War is, you know, getting us into proxy wars in Vietnam and Bangladesh and all sorts of places. Wow.
Well, there's one little addition to that. You know, we can get into the rapture in a moment, but this little part of rapture theology in the book of Revelation was that after the world is destroyed, or like a third of humanity is killed, there'll be a one world government that the Antichrist will set up with a single currency called the Mark of the Beast. It's a tattoo on your right hand or your forehead, basically a biological credit card. And so that was a convenient tie-in for a lot of these preachers to say, like, the Antichrist will be a communist and his government will be a communist government. And so a lot of people saw the USSR as sort of the rise of the Antichrist and the Book of Revelation coming to fruition.
That and also, obviously, with the threat of nuclear war, that certainly dovetails well with the idea of Revelation and a global apocalypse. You know, it's such an easy narrative. Everyone was worried about it, right? At any moment, you'd have to hide under your school desk and put a newspaper over your head and get vaporized. So another aspect of this, and I actually wrote about this to some degree in my book, The Enlightenment Trap, because I saw parallels with this fundamentalist bent in Buddhism. But there's this idea of the prosperity gospel. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me what that is, where that comes from?
It's a very Reagan era economic theory of magical thinking via prayer, morality, very much tying your faith in with your finances. There was this famous preacher called Oral Roberts out of Oklahoma, started Oral Roberts University. He was on TV everywhere. Him and others started creating this own little avenue of theology called prosperity gospel, which basically told you that not only is your morality, your sin or your righteousness tied to your success, like God will bless you if you're praying regularly, if you're not sinning, and if you're poor, that can be viewed in this culture as evidence of your lack of faith or that you have sin in your life. There's something that's keeping you from God's will. But the big engine of it is giving money to a church. You know, they would say giving money to God. You know, there's a phrase that he used, planting your seed faith. And there's scriptural ties to this about, you know, God blessing you, you know, in all areas of your life, that you'll have riches abundantly. And but that's something that they tie specifically into your bank account. And the rhetoric often went for each offering, each seed faith offering that you gave to the church. And this is on top of your 10% tithe every week.
Of course. I mean, come on.
An extra gift to the Lord. You will be blessed with a tenfold return or sevenfold. Some people have different ideas from it. And it's most popular in areas of economic desperation. A lot of developing nations have a lot of prosperity gospel preachers. But where I come from in Iowa, I was born in 1982, just as the farm crisis was really getting moving. And there were foreclosures happening left and right. The suicide rate exploded 400% in my state around this time. So, and then that infected all areas of the economy. So things were just in bad shape in the Midwest. And so it was a perfect opportunity to say, like, you're desperate. Well, you need to show your faith by giving to the church. Often beyond your means, you know, the bigger leap of faith you're making, the bigger return you will get. So it encouraged people to go into debt or to spend recklessly. And at one time, my parents were giving the same amount of money from their businesses to the church that they were taking home. So it was 100% of their income was being being matched to the church. And this was when we were making like $10,000 a year for a family of five.
So this is actually like sort of a step up from, you know, the Protestant work ethic and the spirit of capitalism. This is that Max Weber's sort of classic sociological text where he said that Americans in particular viewed their wealth as a sign of God's favor, right? You know, but you're saying it's like, not even that. It's like, yeah, if you're wealthy, obviously you're close to God, but the best way to get God's favor and to get him to, you know, give you your 7 to 10 time return, depending on your particular faith, is to actually bankrupt yourself. And these people were happy to take that that money.
And the lavish lifestyles that we know of a lot of televangelist preachers at the time, you know, thinking of Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, or Jimmy Swaggart of the 80s and 90s, they could justify their private planes, their gold watches, their mansions by saying this is evidence of God's favor, and at the same time preach that to their congregation. I mean, we had a pastor at my church in Iowa who was constantly telling us about how much money he had, about the vacations he went on, and he was preaching to a congregation of very poor people who were shopping at thrift stores, on food stamps, their cars were breaking down, you know, everyone in the family was working and they're barely scraping by. And it's, even when I was a believer as a young man, I was like, you know, this prosperity gospel seems to be working out really well for one specific person. You know, it really works, you know, when you're telling us your story of wealth, but it is us that's happen.
You're welcome for your aircraft. Where is my sevenfold return coming in? I mean, it's so mixed up with the American economy, the sort of belief in hard work gets you exceptionalism, and our desire not to take charity, but to earn things with our own good works. And that it's, and also, like, it seems like there's a connection here to, like, social media, or, you know, with social media, like, if you look on, like, Instagram, everyone's, like, wealthy and having good time, they have great tan and they're getting their six packs, right? And they're all, you know, just rolling in it. If you look at your typical Instagram celebrity, have we seen sort of an acceleration in the expansion of the appeal of evangelicalism in the social media age, or has it become more diffuse? Now you're like, oh no, I'm going to be a wellness. I'm going to give my money, tithe my money to some wellness dude instead.
Yeah. It fits hand in glove with the social media culture, this idea of fake it till you make it. You know, we hear that a lot in multi-level marketing pyramid schemes, which are also an offshoot of evangelical culture. And it's really the idea of presenting an image of success. There was that character in American Beauty who said to Annette Bening, you know, in order to be successful, one must project an image of success at all times.
Right.
And that really was what was driven home for me. And I saw a lot of people go into debt really just to maintain a kind of facade. And they had lovely houses on the lake. They had nice cars. Their kids wore, you know, designer clothes to school. And then later on, and I write about this in the book I'm working on now, I worked for a debt collection agency for a brief time when I was a young man. And I saw a lot of these people in that database and saw, like, oh, wow, you weren't wealthy at all. You just had this appearance of it. And so that puts you in a hole financially and then also psychologically, because you can't really be authentic with your community, with even your family, your coworkers. And as Brené Brown has told us, authenticity is the ticket to, you know, happiness, human connection. And so it's a very synthetic, manufactured lifestyle that's very toxic.
Yeah. And, like, in America, everyone in America says that they're middle class, right? Like, no one you meet, like, whether it's the billionaire or the janitors, ever says that they're anything but middle class. And because being poor, or in some, and it's better to be rich than poor, obviously, but, like, we don't have, like, a community of people who get together and say, we're poor and we actually have rights. It's like, no, we're going to fake it. We're going to pretend not to be desperate, because we don't want to be a welfare queen or, you know, someone who's taking from the system. Wow. Fascinating. Well, all right, let's get it back into your own upbringing a little bit, because one, I want to hear more about this, you working at a debt collection agency and seeing your buddies there. But, you know, let's go, like, what was young Josiah like? What was your religious background? And, you know, what did a church service look like for you at that age, at, you know, whatever age you think is the right one to go into?
Yeah, I was a very nervous child, very much in my own head, very shy, very anxious, partly because of the home I grew up in, but also because of this rhetoric I was getting from the church about hell, salvation, the rapture, everything. My parents were part of what's known as the Jesus movement of the 1970s that Bob Dylan was a part of. It was basically this big movement of hippies getting sober for Jesus. That's where Christian rock comes out of. and they believed that the world was going to end around 1988-ish. There was this book, The Late Great Planet Earth, that was one of the best-selling books of the 70s that had all these prophecies of the world ending. So it's very much on my mind and the people that I grew up with, and then later on in the 90s with the Left Behind books. But the church that I went to...
Kirk Cameron starred in that series, as I recall.
Yeah. He's a big Christian right icon, Kirk Cameron. And Nicolas Cage was in one about 10 years ago. But a typical church service in the church that I grew up in, it was called Agape Christian Family Church. It used to be called Agape Temple, but they had to change their name after the Jim Jones incident. Everyone called us a cult. I mean, our church building was a pyramid. We were Pentecostal.
Schemes. I don't know why they call them schemes, but they like that.
We were Pentecostals, which is an offshoot of Protestant evangelicalism that's defined by like a charismatic church service, very emotional, upbeat music, drums, guitars. Think of U2, Coldplay, you know, that kind of anthemic rising music. People would be jumping up and down. They'd wave their arms in the air, but there would also be speaking in tongues.
Yeah.
I spoke in tongues almost every day until I was 17 or so. And there would be the falling on the ground and shaking, which is called slain in the spirit. Altar calls where people go up and the pastor will touch his hand on your head and you'd fall to the ground. Maybe have a vision. There'd be like laughing. There's this thing called drunk in the spirit, where people would be laughing and falling all over each other like they're in a bar, but everyone is sober. And so it's not a, you know, you think of like a lot of Jewish communities are very theological in their approach to God and their faith, and they think about it and they struggle with it and they read the text. We weren't like that. We were emotional. We felt God. And that gave me a very skewed relationship with spirituality, because on the other side of that coin was a whole lot of fear. We put on passion plays where you see Jesus, you know, think of the Passion of the Christ, very violent stories of Jesus' death, but also plays where families are dragged to hell. We put on hell houses, which are haunted houses with a Christian message behind them. They're very, very terrifying. So,
and you're this whole time you're worried that you're going to be raptured away or not raptured away, right? You want to be raptured. You want to be vanished and go into heaven right before the apocalypse. And this is playing on your mind all the time as a child, right? You know, it's not like, you know, usually when, you know, when I grew up, you know, maybe I was afraid of the boogeyman or something. And my parents would be like, oh no, the boogeyman's not real. You know, the monster under your bed's not real, but your parents sort of gave you a different message.
Yeah, my parents and the community that I was in, because I was going to church like 9 times a week. I was involved in so many different churches. I had nothing in my life that wasn't church related. No baseball, no, you know, after school activities. It was all church camp, conventions, Christian rock. So it was just around me incessantly. And yeah, I thought about death and hell pretty much every day of my life. The concept of eternity would give me panic attacks. Just because, you know, you can't get your head around that. As a 40-year-old now, it would be difficult to, you know, really take in eternity. But we had this rapture theology, this rapture fever that was around us all the time that really connected the headlines of the day to the Book of Revelation and other parts of the Bible, the Book of Daniel, Book of Ezekiel. That kind of created this like 20th century theology called the rapture. And that word isn't in the Bible. You know, it's very much like sort of picking and choosing your own little scriptures to create this narrative that was very popular with the Jesus movement. That's sort of where a lot of it was formulated. And it was basically the righteous will be taken up into heaven. Maybe like a third or two thirds of the earth will vanish. Everyone left behind will suffer the tribulation, which is a lot of war, famine, pestilence, the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
You're living in Cormac McCarthy's The Road, basically, right? It's bad.
Yeah. Well, even that was more peaceful than the Book of Revelation, because there will be like locusts with the heads of lions that will be torturing people. At least on The Road, like the father and son got some respite from the nightmare of their lives. This is basically agonizing torture 100% of the time, where you pray for death and won't get it.
Oh my God, that's horrendous. All right, so man, this is heavy. This is really heavy stuff. I have a question. I want to go back a second and talk about the experience of speaking in tongues, the slayings, and what is that like? Because, so my reference point is Buddhism, right? Because that's mm-hmm. the sort of more what I know about. And there's certainly things in that tradition called kriyas, they call them. You have kundalini rising. You have these other things, which are remarkably similar and probably honestly the same thing as what's going on in the Christian tradition. What happens to you that when the priest touches your head, you perform the action that everyone else is like what, when you're speaking in tongues, or I don't know when the last time you did it, like what happens in your brain and your body?
Yeah. I can talk about this from a personal and scientific standpoint. There's been a lot of research around speaking in tongues from a neurological level. Cause there's this belief that it's an actual language. It's a heavenly language that you're being blessed with. But, brain scans of people speaking in tongues show that the language centers of the brain are shut down. The temporal lobe is activated. So it's a very emotional, sort of unconscious process. And linguists have studied it. There's not really any kind of consistency to the fluctuations in tone.
What does it sound like?
Shundala, skadalala, skadalala. It's like a staccato burst of syllables. And it's very difficult to do. Even like I've done it like at readings, I've written a lot about this, or in audiobooks, and it's something where I can't really think with my language mind like I'm doing right now when I'm speaking. I really do have to like turn off. But you hear it so much around you when you're growing up that it's not really anything you have to work that hard to achieve. But I was kind of pressured into it at church camp. They encourage you to fake it at first. It's again, like fake it till you make it. There are these phrases like untie my bow tie, Honda. I forget exactly what it is, but you say these things and they kind of sound like speaking in tongues, and then it like flows from there. But it's actually something people ask me a lot, if this was the trauma of my youth, and it actually wasn't. It was the great bliss of my youth, these Pentecostal experiences, the jumping up and down, the shaking, the crying. It was a communal experience that as a non-believer adult, I would try and recreate it like dance clubs or with drugs or rock concerts. It's a sort of visceral, kinetic feeling. And a lot of ex-evangelicals will talk about how they went to rock concerts and they realized like, oh, I just like these lights and sounds and communal experiences that I had attributed to the Holy Spirit, which is what supposedly happens to you when you're speaking in tongues and slaying the Spirit. It's
right.
The Holy Spirit coming into your body and taking charge. And it's very euphoric. You do feel bliss. You do feel this like primal release of emotion that is quite lovely. And I was very sad when I lost my faith and could no longer achieve that.
So that's a really nice segue into when you left the church, right? Because, you know, at some point, you know, what I know about you, obviously, is that, you know, you have left the movement. There is something called the ex-evangelical movement, of which, you know, look, you're covered in tattoos. You just wrote a book about doing drugs and running. Like, you're still on the speaking in tongues train, but you're finding it in sort of different, I guess, is this secular? Is it what, I don't even know what to call the other side of this. And, you know, you've written other books, you know, this series called Carnality, which is, you know, it's about the sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's like, it's the other extreme, right? It's like, you're still to some degree still speaking in tongues, but with a whole different set of tongues right now. What is the ex-evangelical movement and how did you come to embrace it?
Well, I stepped out of my faith around, I want to say like 2002, 2003. I'm on the older end of millennials. But the ex-evangelical movement really started to appear around the 2016 election of Donald Trump. That's when we get the term ex-evangelical. This guy, Brian Chastain, starts the ex-evangelical podcast. Chrissy Stroop starts all this Twitter activism. There's a Church 2 hashtag that accompanied the Me Too movement. And so it was very much like an internet groundswell. The same thing we've seen with Mormons or Scientologists, you know, people sort of realizing they all had the same experiences internally in their own minds, in their own bodies, but they kept it to themselves. And often you don't embrace these thoughts, these questions, because your belief is your salvation. It's your ticket out of hell. So you're not really going to, there's no incentive for curiosity or for dismantling your belief system. But when I was 19 or so, I had, you know, a lot of trauma, a lot of baggage. I'd flunked out of school. That's a whole other story that is connected to my faith and my religious trauma. But there were just too many questions that had been accumulating in my mind ever since I was 6-7 years old. You know, who wrote the Bible? What about all these other faiths? Learning that there were like 10,000 different religions in the world and 40,000 different branches of Christianity, but ours was the one true one on the north end of Clear Lake, Iowa, like not all the other Christian churches in our area. And I happened to be born at the right time in the right place. Like, it just didn't really compute for me. And then learning about the history of the Bible, how it was written, how it was assembled, the scribes that changed things, the languages it was translated into. Really, it just the sort of cartoonish fundamentalist mindset that had been prescribed to me just no longer fit with all the questions that I had. And I didn't abandon my belief or the church. It just like slipped through my fingers, and I didn't want that to happen. But then eventually at some point I embraced it and started writing about it a lot, and just happened to, you know, years later find that there were millions of other young people, well, people older than me, people younger than me, that all have this very similar narrative of around like 17 to 22, they started asking really difficult questions that they couldn't get satisfying answers to. And when you're a fundamentalist, when it's either 100% true or not, then there's not really any room for, you know, I'm going to continue to be a believer or identify as a Christian, and just not really in the same way. I think that was the case for some people. I don't want to say like everyone became Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens, but I certainly did at some point, because I was quite angry and felt a little stupid for believing what I did.
Well, you said something really, I think, quite salient to just to go back to this. You know, there's 40,000 religions, right? So many offshoots of Christianity alone. And why is it my one little small church, my rinky dinky church, wherever it is, that makes me the one who is like the essentially the hero of this narrative, right? It sort of places the individual at the center of the story, because like, why not here? Well, it's because I'm here, because I'm experiencing this. Therefore, I am special, and my specialness can go either to hell in that big narrative or to heaven in that big narrative. But like, in these movements, and I think Americans in general often think that we are the protagonists in a larger story about America. Like, that's why I tweet angrily on the internet, because I think I can change Donald Trump's mind. It's never going to happen, right? And it really plays into, you know, just a general way that I think that we are self-centered as humans. And that's and then these movements come in and just grab that and twist it to their own you know, agendas on whatever direction that goes. And I think that as all of these people sort of, you know, some people sort of wake up and like you, they say, oh, of course I'm not the protagonist, but so many more stay in. Do you have any idea of how, you know, right now, I think that religious people, like people who actually attend church, that is way down in America right now. But what about these people who are still in those communities? What does that world look like right now?
Small, mm-hmm. as you mentioned, my church, Agape Christian Family, were, you know, a few hundred people, maybe 300 or 400 at one time. I don't know if more than a dozen people show up, to Sunday services now. They're selling their pyramid building, because can't afford it anymore. Going back to their roots, when my parents helped found it in 1980, of being in movie theaters, renting out movie theaters on Sunday mornings, or they'll probably go back to people's living rooms, mm-hmm. you know, like the early Christians. And there's a real sense of martyrdom. Christian mm-hmm. evangelical Christians love to be martyred or view themselves as martyrs. It was mm-hmm. a big thing in the 90s when I was a kid during Columbine, Marilyn Manson. There were all these books about martyrs that were very popular with young people. We had this song, Jesus Freak, that was really all about yeah. like being mm-hmm. hated. And we were told that we would, in the afterlife, be get rewards for, you know, the more persecution that we took on in this life. So it's something that you can still look at, you know, just like with prosperity gospels, you can look at your success as evidence of God's favor. Well, it goes the other way too. You know, mm-hmm. if your church is failing, if people aren't showing up, young people aren't interested anymore, that's because of what Satan is doing in America. You know, you can blame it on transgender people. You can blame it on the Democrats. You know, in the 80s, it was satanic panic. But mm-hmm. there's always some kind of evil force that is attacking you. And that's why things aren't working out the way.
Because you're still chosen, right? You're for sure yeah. still chosen, but Satan has his little war that he's carrying out, and he's winning right now. So it actually sort of like, you know, makes that religious community more of a crucible. Like you have to either hold on, like it's a loss leader, right? Like you, like once, if you've embraced this big idea that has defined your identity, it's very difficult to go against that. Right. Mm-hmm. And if you break with it, you break hard.
Yeah. And a lot of times your life is wrapped up in it. Your community, your income, a lot of the times, if you're, mm-hmm. you know, a Christian author or a pastor or a worship leader, you know, you probably went to a Christian college like Bethel or Wheaton or Evangel. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so to step out of that and enter, say, the secular market or the secular culture, you're kind of lost. You yeah. don't know how to relate to other people. And it's like, you know, the North Koreans who go to South Korea and suddenly they just have no idea how to exist in a right. free society. I mean, that's an extreme example, but for a lot of people, it is that kind of huge culture shock. So there aren't really incentives to make that leap.
Yeah, you mentioned sort of like mainstream culture, and there's actually been two messages in what we're talking about here, and they actually are somewhat contradictory. On one hand, there's this feeling that this hardcore evangelicalism is somewhat on the wane, like religiosity is somewhat on the wane in mainstream America, because people, maybe the Cold War has subsided enough that people are, you know, have different anxieties. But on the other hand, the evangelical movement seems to play an outsized role in American politics and in the mainstream media. You know, we have, you know, the rise of purity culture, right? And, you know, we see this in like Promise Rings, but we also see this in like the Proud Boys idea of semen retention, right? Mm-hmm. There's a whole purity thing going on. And then it's also linked to Hollywood in general. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. There's two documentaries out right now about Hillsong Church, which is this worldwide mega church, sort of hipster church, it's often referred to as, that started in Australia, but had these very large churches, still do. I don't think they're quite as popular as they were in New York and LA. And a lot of celebrities would show up to them, Justin Bieber being the most famous. He was best buddies with the lead pastor at Hillsong New York City. But also, what's his name? The Guardians of the Galaxy, Parks and Rec guy. His name escapes me at the moment. But Selena Gomez went to Hillsong Church. Kanye West, I believe, has attended at
times.
Well,
what hasn't he gone
to? Kardashians. Sorry?
Well, what hasn't he gone to, right?
Well, and Kanye West was part of sort of this LA Christian revival. I mean, he put out a Christian rock album.
Yeah.
He led these like Sunday worship services at Coachella. He really is the embodiment of Christian right cool in a lot of ways, which is something that's been around for a long time, but now has as much controversy and exposés surrounding it is still very, very popular. And it is
why
sort of
is it crossing
a lot of
Sorry? Why is it crossing over then? Like, you know, if people are being less religious, and yet so many Hollywood stars also mm-hmm. seem to have a connection to these movements. Like, why is it because like a religious movement provides a religious community provides like a network that helps propel fame, even if it's small? Or is there something else going on there?
That's part of it. There's a two-way relationship to it in that way for both the church and the celebrities. But also, these services are very enjoyable. Mm-hmm. They have very expensive light shows and sound mm-hmm. systems, and they have really great mm-hmm. bands playing this music that when you're a part of it and you're in a crowd of 10,000 people, yeah. you know, like you're going to go to Red Rocks later tonight. It's a very mm-hmm. similar thing. You know, you're cheering, you're being entertained. And it's Sunday morning. It's not something that's connected like with alcohol. Right. Or any sort of debauchery. So afterwards you walk out of there feeling a sort of lightness in your heart. Mm-hmm. And then also there's a lot of money involved. Yeah. You know, you're getting 10% of this congregation's income. And in Hillsong's case, it's millions of people.
Yeah. And you better put on a good show if you're going to get 10%. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of wealthy people are attracted to it. And you're right that there is a networking component. You're going to be around people who are involved in similar business ventures as mm-hmm. you. And there's a social media component in that, like you can take some selfies at this church and tag yourself in them. And then suddenly you're part of this bigger network. So there's a lot of incentives to be a part of it.
And I would also think to some degree, you know, if we think about the prosperity gospel, if you're a movie star and you go to the church and they're like, oh, look, you're famous and therefore you have God's favor, you know, or in Scientology's case, you know, you're Tom Cruise and we have a whole church, a side church just for celebrities. Like mm-hmm. it does actually make sense because it's, you know, celebrities like affirmation, right? Mm-hmm. And who doesn't like affirmation? And now you have a huge community of people basically telling you you're not only famous, you're almost supernatural.
Mm-hmm. And you're right. There's a, like with Scientology, they can say, we made Tom Cruise, we made John Travolta. Mm-hmm. They weren't very popular or successful until they embraced the teachings of Scientology. And Scientology yeah. was so popular and so wealthy in the 80s and 90s that they really could make that happen. They really did have the power to, you know, influence Hollywood and make someone's career. And the mm-hmm. same thing, you know, happens in evangelical churches as well. These people are mm-hmm. very well connected politically, and you can make a career based on that. Look at Kevin Sorbo. He was known for starring as Hercules in the 90s series.
Oh, yeah,
Xena
right.
was a spinoff mm-hmm. of that.
For sure.
He has a very robust career in Christian movies, which have a huge audience. I mean, these movies are costing, you know, maybe tens of thousands of dollars and making millions of dollars. And when you watch these movies, you see people like Dean Cain, he was Superman in them, or in the 80s, it was Gary Busey and Mr. T. Well, in the 90s when their careers weren't so
Wait,
big.
Mr. T?
Yeah, he was in the Apocalypse, Caught in the Eye of the Storm series. Margot Kidder, who was in the Superman movies. You see the same thing today. Melissa Joan Hart from Clarissa Explains It All in Sabrina the Teenage Witch. She's now in a God's Not Dead movie. So that you can revive your career in this other avenue. And then you can say, look, we were rejected by Hollywood because of our faith. You know, we are martyrs. We were cast out of this evil, corrupt pedophile organization. Yeah. And now we're with the pure people over here making Christian movies. Yeah.
That's going to be my move once people no longer buy my books or, you know, subscribe to my YouTube channel. I'm going to make the Christian hard right turn for the money. I think it seems like a great plan, and you know, maybe we'll have people vote in the comments to see if that's a good idea and what philosophy I should actually choose, because there's so many to choose from. All right, another thing, I mean, this goes back to sort of the habitus, the speaking in tongues side of things that we were talking about a little bit earlier. Another thing that you noticed that you were part of or you had seen were exorcisms. All right, and this is like sort of a tried and true trope in religious communities, not only in Christianity, but actually exists in almost all religious traditions. What role does that play in the communities that you were part of? And what is this idea of like spiritual warfare that exists there?
Yeah. That was maybe the most insidious part of my childhood, was this idea of spiritual warfare, supernatural warfare, basically the idea that there are angels and demons around us in a invisible dimension that we cannot see, but they are trying to influence us one way or another, to either sin or pray. And so really, your thoughts, your body, your sensations, aren't your own in that dynamic. For most of my childhood, I could not trust my own thoughts, my own curiosity, because I believed that there were demons in my head speaking to me. And so
Wait. The belief system you had believed that your own thoughts were not your thoughts, but they could be someone else's thoughts in your head, and these thoughts were made by demons.
Yes, that it's a plan by Satan to get you to sin. And so, especially when you're...
Then who are you?
Exactly. There's all sorts of questions about consciousness and identity. And, you know, that became a theme of mine years later when learning about neurology. But when I was a kid, I was just constantly vigilant to sort of guard my thoughts. And this is one of the reasons I flunked out of school, was I wouldn't really allow myself to think about history, to think about, you know, different religions, to, you know, my mind was just exclusively guarding, you know, anything that could threaten my belief. But the idea was that Satan would use things like movies, like music, drugs, sexuality, as sort of a little wedge, you know, to use your phrase.
I appreciate that.
to sort of sneak in, to set up residence inside of your mind and in your body. And so we really believe that, like, listening to Marilyn Manson could result in you being infected with demons. And spending time with people who are infected with demons means that you're more likely to. So I would often,
so it's
like,
sort of like a germ.
Yeah, very much so. And then the opposite would be true as well, spending more time at church around other Christians in prayer. We were called prayer warriors a lot of the time, and we would pray over the seats, over the technology like the projector or the musical instruments, to sort of essentially exorcise them of any sort of evil presence. And so at church camp, I saw, you know, in these altar calls where things are all Pentecostal, people are shaking and crying and screaming about their sins. You know, they would say, like, in the name of Jesus, I reject this demon of homosexuality that has affected this boy. And the boy would grunt and growl and, you know, sometimes speak on behalf of the demon. And people would speak to the demon like Jesus did when, you know, he would ask the demon its name and cast him into the pigs. This stuff happened quite regularly.
Cast him into the pigs?
That's in, I think, the book of Matthew. After the Sea of Galilee calms the storms, they go to an island. There's this man who we would say he has schizophrenia today, but Jesus exorcised him, and he cast the demons into these pigs, and then all the pigs jumped off this cliff and killed themselves. The farmer who owned the pigs was very upset about this.
Well, this sounds really similar to Odysseus.
Yeah. There are so many stories of the Bible that are found in other faiths. I mean, it's really like a greatest hits of Mediterranean religions. Jesus himself has so many connections to other gods.
You know, it's funny. I have never read the Bible. I've read lots of religious texts, but the Bible is one that I've sort of flipped through. And like, I just can't. It's not a gripping read for me, but I imagine as a child, you probably read quite a bit of it.
I did. I participated in Bible quiz. So I could recite a lot of it, but you know, we're as Protestants, we're supposed to be different from Catholics in that we don't need the Pope or a priest to interpret the Bible for us, but we kind of do. It's nothing that people dig into that voraciously, and certainly not with different versions of the Bible. People stick with the New International Version mostly in their teen study Bibles with a lot of modern language in them. But it is just a big mess. And I think reading the Bible was one of the things where I'm like, why is this what I'm centering my life around? Because it's like reading the entrails of a chicken.
Which is a really good point, because it's like all of the ancient texts are a little all over the place. You know, like Gilgamesh is all over the place. Like the Rig Veda is all over the place. And yet to vaunt it into a holy status, primarily because it's old, although the Bible does have an interesting history on how it was compiled, but we're not going to get into here. It's this idea that a text, it can be the literal word of God, which is, you know, that's actually not just a Christian idea. Like the Buddhists think that too. Like the Buddha said, and the Buddha was the word of God. So the Buddha said this, and they also have their fundamentalist thing going on. We also have in the Quran, right, this fundamentalist idea, this is the literal word of God. And it seems to me that these strains all sort of connect. I mean, you could say that, you know, the Taliban and the evangelical sort of fundamentalist movement have actually a lot of like theological overlap.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're all, in those cases, they're both Abrahamic religions. So they do kind of stem from the same place. Evangelical Christians don't really care to be reminded of that fact, you know, or really the existence of any other faith. I mean, it does threaten your belief, your certainty, your narcissism that you're in the right one true faith, because to think that you're just one of tens of thousands of beliefs, you know, it makes it more difficult to maintain that facade. But it was, I remember clearly a moment when I went to Christian schools and the public school at various times. And I remember in the public school, eighth grade, having a teacher who was pointing out these similarities between Greek mythology and Christian mythology, making connections between Pandora's box and the Garden of Eden, or Prometheus and Jesus. Mm-hmm. And I had watched Hercules. I was a big fan of the show Hercules. And I thought of those as like tall tales, like Paul Bunyan, Pecos Bill, things that were just kind of silly little ideas that we love to play with. And then this teacher saying like, yeah, and the Christian stories are exactly like that. And I remember first being troubled by that and then instantly thinking that's Satan in my head trying to tempt me. And so you need to just shut it down, expel the thought, that curiosity trail out of your mind. And that's really what prevented a lot of my intellectual growth as a young person, but then eventually became what I built a career on, essentially. I mean, as journalists, we're essentially paid to be curious, to, you know, think, oh, isn't that weird? Let's learn a little bit more about that. And let's, you know, connect dots between all these disparate ideas. It's very frowned upon inside that culture.
It's interesting. There's like this, like you really described that mechanism really well, where we have this, or not, the people in these organizations have like a mechanism to deal with a thought that challenges them. Nope, that's Satan. And the person saying that can do nothing about, they cannot, oh, once I'm a demon, once you've called me a demon, what can the demon say to convince you that they're not a smooth-tongued serpent in reality?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a phrase, I think in atheist circles, called intellectual suicide. that's championed essentially in evangelical culture. There's a famous moment where Billy Graham was having a crisis of confidence. This is before his career really took off. His sermon writing partner just became an atheist after the news of the Holocaust came out, all of the footage of the Holocaust. He was like, I can't believe in God anymore if he would allow something like this to happen. And Billy Graham was troubled by this, but there's a famous moment that, where he's praying at a rock. There's a little plaque on this rock, and it's in his autobiography where he says, God, there are a lot of things about the Bible I don't understand. There seems to be contradictions in here. There's a lot of questions that I don't have answers for, but I am going to live by faith, and I am going to just have faith that you have answers to these questions and that they are beyond me. And I'm going to move forward with the belief that you are God, you are in heaven, you are the one truth, the way, the light, and not really trouble myself with all of these questions. I would have loved to have done that as a young person, but I couldn't, you know, make that leap.
So how do we, I mean, it sounds like, I mean, you said you grew up in people called your organization a cult, right? In a world where we have, where we don't want people to be this isolated, we don't want people to commit intellectual suicide. Like, how do you talk to a Christian who is in this or this, you know, because they're not bad people, right? They're fundamentally not bad people. They may have bad actions and sort of a weird ideology, but I have this faith. Maybe this is a faith that I have that people are generally good and they generally have good intentions. How do you talk with somebody who's in this organization? How did your, maybe what your story is and how did you got out of that movement? Mm-hmm. What do we do with that segment of the population that's here, or can you do anything with that segment?
I think there are things you can do. I do remember a phase of my life, and maybe I'm still kind of in it, where I was afraid of debating Christians out of their faith because I didn't enjoy losing my faith. It was actually quite traumatic. It sort of slipped through my fingers. And so I, you know, when I'm talking to my family or friends that I grew up with, who, you know, get so much out of this belief, but also would lose so much if it fell apart, I didn't want to put them through that experience. But also, I think people not living up to the caricature of liberals, of intellectuals that a lot of evangelicals have about these cultures, these communities, you know, that they're going to be made fun of, you know, Bill Maher, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, they're people that I loved as in my 20s and still appreciate a great deal, but they do kind of play into this narrative of the Hollywood intellectual coastal elites that a lot of Christians have. So I think one way would be to listen to them, make them feel heard and respected, and like you legitimately have curiosity and you're not just trying to get to the point where you can make them feel stupid. Yeah. Because so much of, not all of them, but a lot of the avenues of the evangelical movement are centered around making fun of believers.
Right.
And
totally.
I get why, you know, I've dabbled in that myself because it's an easy laugh a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to get followers and, you know, get people to pay attention to you, you know, that's basically what that movie Religious was all about. But I think if they feel listened to, they may reciprocate, you know, that openness and less of a reactive hard edge.
Right. And they may also have questions that are gnawing at them as well, because you can never know what's going on in another person's mind, right? And I think that's really good advice to, you know, to be open to listening, because no one wants to be told they're dumb, right? That's like the best way to have someone to be like, yeah, I ain't talking to you because I don't, you know, that's mean, ultimately. Well, this has like been a fascinating conversation, and I'd love to point people towards the work that you do. I mean, obviously you have this book called The Runner's High, which, you know, the message of the book, folks, is do some weed and go on a run. I mean, do some weed and go on a run and buy Josiah's book while you're running, or listen to it on audiobook while you're running, and realize that running is is you may not be the best at running, but it's way pleasurable if you're high. In fact, well, probably the only way.
You know, you love cycling and not running. Yes. I mean, it's really any kind of aerobic activity. It activates the endocannabinoid system and makes you feel good.
Right. For me, running is actually, it's like I was in an environment where there were lion-headed flies trying to eat me. Like, that's like sort of what I feel about running. But I love cycling. So yes, do it stoned. And that is something that I absolutely endorse. And if people are going to find you, it's Josiah Hesse. That's who you've been listening to. There will be links to his stuff down there. He's got, you know, Instagram. I believe you're on Twitter, maybe. But you have this newsletter and his website. So go check these things out. Link in the bio, but you can also just say them right now.
Yeah, on Instagram, I'm at JoJoDancer3000. Twitter, at Josiah M. Hesse. My website is josiahhesse.com. My author pages on Vice or The Guardian have a lot of the content that we've been talking about today.
Yeah. And he's got this great article about him going to an evangelical church who is preaching the prosperity gospel. It was in The Guardian, or maybe that was Vice. Go check that out.
That was The Guardian.
And thank you so much, everyone, for being here. Again, if you want to support amazing journalism, go check out down in the bio. There is my Patreon stuff, all of the things that you might need, including more information about Josiah. This was Scott Carney Investigates by Pokey Bear LLC in Denver, Colorado.